Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
My guest this week is Peter Heather, who has written the book Christendom, which is a brilliant account of the Christianization and mapping Christendom in Europe. You are not a Christian yourself, so how did a non-Christian end up writing a book about the Christianization of Europe and mapping Christendom?
Well, I don't have any kind of active belief now. I did have a religious phase in my teenage years. The thing that makes a lot of my friends laugh the most is that at one point I did think I wanted even to become an Anglican priest, but that proved ephemeral rather than constant. But of course, I'm a medieval historian, and you can't do medieval history without being very interested in the history of Christianity. And having had a pretty strong, actually, religious faith, then I've always been interested in Christianity and very interested in the long-term patterns of change within it. I mean, that's the focus of the book, as you've seen, but that's also what interests me. Yeah.
But we're going to focus a lot on the Christianization of Europe in this episode, and that is, of course, part of the book as well. Because you started at the time of Constantine, but I want to begin a little bit before that, because I feel like to understand Christianity before Constantine, it's important as well. Because as we mentioned before on this podcast, it was not a happy time to be a Christian before Constantine legalized Christianity.
Yeah, it was periodically very unpleasant. The Roman state doesn't persecute Christianity constantly, but every so often a policy of persecution gets dragged out for a particular emperor's own personal political reasons.
Nero is a famous example after the fire of Rome,
or Decius in the 3rd century, even Marcus Aurelius in the middle of the 2nd century. It's usually pulled out as a kind of representative of the other, of the unwanted strangeness, and to show that the current emperor is strong at upholding traditional values. And in these persecutions, you know, several hundred people died. It's very hard to estimate the number of early Christian martyrs, because you get a lot of amplification of the numbers after Constantine. But you're looking certainly at least around 1,000, and maybe a few more, who definitely were killed for their faith. And of course, you've got a lot of others who were imprisoned for a period, who lost their social status, whose lives were massively dislocated. So the Roman state was not a pleasant interlocutor for Christianity in those first 3 centuries AD, not at all. Yeah.
And as the Jews would become to Christianity, the Christians would be the easiest scapegoat. And as we mentioned, the fire of Rome, of course, under Nero, they would become the scapegoats, as would be later cases, or maybe earlier as well. So it would be kind of easy to blame the Christians for the bad things that happened in the Roman Empire, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think that's certainly early on, that is precisely the role in which they're being used. And at that point, of course, most of Roman society doesn't know very much about Christians, so it's very easy to spread scare stories about what Christian rituals involved, the whole body and blood business. And the communion was one source of fake news about human sacrifice and whatever. And that, interestingly, that does change over time as Christians become a more normal part of the sort of urban fabric of Roman towns. I mean, people don't stop thinking that Christians are odd, but they do start thinking that they're not inherently toxic and dangerous. And by the time we get to the last of the Roman persecutions, the great one in the early 4th century, what's really striking about that compared to earlier persecutions is the limited amount of local enthusiasm for the act of persecution. That last persecution is very much a top-down process, whereas prior to that, certainly in the first and second centuries, and the earliest ones we know about, then sometimes emperors are responding to local complaints about Christians. So local societies don't like having Christians in their midst and complain about it, and that's what triggers persecution. But that kind of strong sense that Christians are weird and strange, I think, has probably gone by about 300.
And I think we mentioned this in the podcast before as well, but and the Romans were normally tolerant of others' religion just as long as it did not coincide or get in the way of their own. So, but what made Christianity this? And then there are letters from Pliny, who writes to the emperor, what should we do with these troublesome Christians? But so what made the Christians so troublesome for the Romans, considering that they normally, like you said, allowed other religion to be practiced?
What was required religiously in the Roman Empire was a very small act of compliance to certain public cults, the Capitoline cults and the Imperial cult. And if you were put on the spot, you were expected to sacrifice to these cults and take part in those celebrations. It was a tiny proportion of most people's religious lives. When you look at the religious complexion of the Greco-Roman world, you know, all the way from Britain to Iraq, there are hundreds of gods and hundreds of cults, because you know these areas had wildly different histories before they end up as part of the Roman Empire, and none of that is kind of stomped on the head and shut down, but you're expected to add acts of compliance towards the imperial cult on top of that. And it's that the Christians weren't willing to do. So they wouldn't sacrifice when required to the public cults of the empire, which, as I said, you know, is a tiny proportion of most people's religious lives, but Christians weren't willing to do it, and therefore that made them a possible target.
So, of course, let's begin with Constantine and how he became a Christian, as according to the legend, of course, which is our cross or a halo, as you talk about in the book. And you explain quite well what this vision that Constantine might have had meant. So but let's get a little bit background as well on Constantine, how he became to get this vision and how Christians became important as a part of his lifetime.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story. When he first becomes emperor in 306, and he's put on the throne by his father's army in York at the British army capital in York. His father Constantius was there with his army, and his army puts, after Constantius dies, they put Constantine on the throne. At that point, there are seven other emperors. There is a huge contest going on for imperial power. And so that's one point to bear in mind. And the second point to bear in mind is that the great persecution of Christians, which had been launched by Diocletian in 302, 303, that was still going on. So the official policy of the Roman state was one of overt and consistent hostility towards Christians, and the Great Persecution is probably the best documented persecution. Several hundred Christians die in it. I mean, not thousands, but several hundred. So it's a serious business. And it's against those two points that you have to look at what Constantine does on the religious front. And you see a slow evolution in his public statements about Christianity. Originally, he simply upholds the policy of Diocletian on the religious front. Then in 310, he changes his policy to adoration of the one unconquered sun god, Helios. In 312, or from 312 onwards, he institutes a policy of religious toleration towards Christians. And when writing to Christians, he says, "I'm of the same religion as you." but his public statements are still mostly monotheistic and ambiguous. So still, unconquered son is all over his coinage. He talks about the one great God. The unconquered son was a kind of pagan monotheistic cult. And then in 324, his public policy changes to one of unambiguous Christianity. The key point about all of these changes, so 310 to sola monotheism, the unconquered son, 312, unconquered son, but saying he's Christian to Christians, only in Christian contexts, 324, I'm absolutely a Christian, and Christianity is right. Each of those marks a moment in his path of power after a victory. So he's won a military victory immediately prior to each change of policy. And what this means, of course, is that part of his story is one of coming out as a Christian, when it's because it's safe for him to say that he is a Christian. In 306, if, as I suspect, he may already have been a Christian, if he'd said he was a Christian in 306, he'd have been one Christian emperor among six others who were pagan at a time when the others were persecuting Christianity, and they would have all just turned on him to get rid of him first. So it's a the vision story about of which there are several variants. He clearly said different things to different people about this. That fits in this quite complicated political story. And it's, I think, at least in part, Constantine's story is not so much one of Christian conversion as of coming out as a Christian when it's politically safe for him to do so.
So it wasn't this spontaneous, oh, I see a halo in this cross in the sky, kind of, let's, at the Battle of Minuan Bridge, let's paint the our shields, I mean, across to win. It wasn't, that's a military story, right?
No, that's clearly not what it clearly was not that. And we do not see a sudden change to avert Christianity after 312 in Constantine's public statements. And indeed, the Arch of Constantine, which he puts up to celebrate that victory in Rome, it's just it's right next to the Colosseum. That has no Christian religious ideology or symbolic representations. There's nothing Christian about the Arch of Constantine whatsoever, which is very striking.
So let's talk about the Minuan Bridge. And now I want to, as I mentioned earlier, you didn't talk about explain, elaborate rather well how in this the halo, as you mentioned in the book, came, how that what reasonable explanation there might be behind the halo in that is seen in the sky before Minuan Bridge.
Yeah, well, the thing is, Constantine is someone who has a lot of visions, or maybe has one vision which he talked about.
I mean, was it that uncommon at that time, though?
Well, it's expected that, I mean, the ideologies current at the time are that Roman emperors are chosen by God, by the divinity. The Roman Empire is the divine vehicle for humankind. So, you know, the Roman Empire is God's special state. The ruler of God's special state is individually chosen by the divinity. Therefore, you expect Roman emperors to have a close relationship with the divinity. So, yes, emperors are kind of expected to have visions and dreams and this kind of stuff, because it's a sign that they are in close touch with God, and they should be in close touch with God. That's their
and
role.
This will be the present all throughout medieval and early European history, right? That the ruler was the chosen representative of God. They would follow this tradition all the way up, at least until maybe even some think they are to this day, that they are chosen by God to rule
it's
their
usually
country.
Looking at that. Yeah, I mean, one of the titles that you see on British coins of British monarchs is Defender of the Faith, which is an echo of this, certainly.
So let's talk about the Minuan Bridge, which would be decisive. And I want to ask as well, because this would change As we know, the fate of Europe, to put it that way, the Battle of Milvian Bridge. But if it had gone the other way around, do you think Christianity still would have been the dominant religion, or do you think it would just a little bit later, or do you think it would have kind of died out in a sense, or what do you think would have happened if the Constantine had lost the Battle of Milvian Bridge?
I certainly think that it's and this is one of the things I'm trying to do in the book, is to rethink the early history of Christianity without assuming that it must win. And I think that's what the history of Christianity in the 20th century, at least in a European context, is telling us we must do. Because actually, at the start of the 20th century, if you asked everyone in Europe, they would say they were Christian, and quite a lot of them were going to churches of one kind or another. And when my grandfather joins the British Army in 1910, he's forced to go to church. You know, there is church parade on Sunday. You have to go to church. This is normal and it's normative. But over the course of the 20th century, we've seen church attendance decline. A lot of people still say they're Christian on censuses or whatever, but they don't actually go to church and they don't organize their lives around Christian festivals. They're not taught by it. So to me, and this is the fundamental drive in the book, that's why I went back to the early history of Christianity. We have seen essentially Christianity lose its hold on the majority of European consciences in the 20th century. So let's rethink the early history of Christianity in the light of that. Let's have a look at the evidence without assuming that it's always destined to win, because we've seen that it's not. So, taking that perspective back to Constantine, one of the things that jumps out to me very much is that the attempts to calculate Christian numbers in the era before Constantine have, I think, a strong tendency to wildly inflate the likelihood. You can't know absolutely, and I wouldn't pretend for a moment that you can, but we know that the empire is divided into about 1800 administrative units. There are Christian communities, places that have a bishop, in only one third of those. That doesn't mean that there's no Christians at all in the other two thirds, but it does mean there's no organized Christian community, so there are probably not very many. And even in the cities, that's what each of these communities is, that does have a Christian community, then Christians are still quite small numbers. Christianity is not spread into the countryside in any substantial way or in most parts of the empire. And most people, of course, are peasants. 90% of the 85, 95, 80 to 9, sorry, 85 to 90% of the population work on the land. So if Christianity is not spread outside actual cities into the countryside, that's a lot of the population that's not going to be Christian. And even in the urban populations, only one third of the cities have any Christian organized community at all. And in no city are Christians the majority. So, you know, you can run the numbers. I do my best to run a conservative ballpark figure. I do not see how you get Christian numbers up above about 2% of the population of the empire at most, and potentially a little bit less than that. So Christians aren't very numerous. They're also not very organized at the time of Constantine. And to me, this is what's so interesting about the conversion of Constantine, that it unleashes this incredible process of transformation, in terms of creating an organized institutional church, increasing numbers of Christians massively, all these kinds of things. And you know, the great Swiss historian Burckhardt, thought that Constantine converted to Christianity because Christianity would make a wonderful partner in the government of the empire. But actually, it's the transformed Christianity that's created by Constantine's conversion, with many more people, much more organization, much more internal definition of faith. It's that entity that makes a good partner. in the running of the empire, and that's created by Constantine's conversion. It doesn't exist before Constantine's conversion. So I'm basically forced back on the conclusion that Constantine converted because he was already probably a Christian, and that when he wins out in the struggle for power within the empire, this allows him to take control of the empire. What that means is that Christianity is a very small, not very united sect within the Roman world in the time of Constantine, and whether that could have found a path to cultural dominance without becoming the religion of the empire, I think that's probably pretty doubtful.
Another thing I want to know is, why did the Jews, and of course this is where the name Roman Catholicism come from, I imagine, but why did they choose Rome as the Pope's seat of power, not Jerusalem? That would make much more sense, considering Jerusalem and Bethlehem is kind of where Jesus spent his time. So why did, I mean, maybe it was a good idea in the long run when we come, I mean, we'll come back to the Crusades, of course, but so maybe it was a good idea, but at the time, for me, it would have made much more sense in Bethlehem or Jerusalem as a seat of power for the Pope. So why Rome?
Well, I think it's a good question. Why not Jerusalem? That goes back to the subsequent history of Jerusalem after Jesus's life and death, because there's a series of major Jewish revolts against Roman rule, and basically the city is destroyed and abandoned for a while in the course of them, and that early Christian community that you get in Acts, so the community that's talked about there, the earliest Christian community that there was, that gets destroyed. And there's no continuity in the Christian community in Jerusalem. So the Christian community that is oldest and has the most continuous history is actually that of Antioch. And soon after that, Alexandria. Rome is also a very early foundation, because of course Peter does go to Rome. Paul is on his way to Rome. There is a Christian community there at the heart of the empire from very, very early on. And actually what we see in...
But also, again, as we will come back to, Constantine does move the capital from Rome to Constantinople or Nueva Roma. So again, Rome would seem, considering you moved the capital as well, that Constantinople even would be a better option, considering that's where it goes to. So Rome,
that is, of course,
like a weird solution.
That is the late Roman pattern. This whole business of papal authority is an incredibly late invention. It's actually an invention of the 11th and 12th century. So the late Roman pattern is, first of all, that emperors, as specifically chosen by God to rule God's special state, they have supreme religious authority, and their chief religious advisors are the heads of the oldest Christian communities, the so-called patriarchs. Rome is one of them, but Alexandria and Antioch consider themselves entirely equal to Rome in the late Roman period, and they add two more. They do indeed add Constantinople, and they do, once there is a Christian community up and running again in Jerusalem, the Bishop of Jerusalem is given patriarchal status as well. So the late Roman pattern is emperors have supreme religious authority because they're chosen by God, and there are five patriarchal advisors, as it were, to him, of which Rome is only one. Now, Rome, bishops of Rome occasionally make noises that they should be more important than any of the other patriarchs, but none of the other patriarchs believe them. And nor do they actually acquire any greater authority in the late Roman period than any of the other patriarchs. So it's very important not to antedate papal authority into too early a period. It's one of those major transformations within Christianity that happens in the medieval period.
And I'm sure we will come back to this later. But I want to talk about after Constantine and with how rapidly did Christianity spread in the Roman world, and from people converting into Christianity and again, this will come back again and again, I'm sure. But as we know, mostly elites, of course, you start with them and then you work your way down. But How quickly did they really convert in? Because as you know, when we come to the Byzantine world, most people, I believe, are Christians, at least in that in the Byzantine world.
We can't, obviously, you can't find out exact numbers, but you can make some clear observations. And that is the first point is that the process, the pattern of the process is that it affects members of the elite classes first. And by about the year 400, so 75 years after Constantine, well, two, three political generations after Constantine, say, you have to be a Christian if you want to participate in the public and administrative life of the empire. That I think is a we don't get any sense that there are a lot of people dropping out who might otherwise participate. So I think the emergence, I mean, that's enforced by legislation. And we get various comments about that in texts that are written by people living around the year 400. That's the state of affairs by 400. You have to be a Christian in some way, shape, or form, with some kind of public allegiance to Christianity by 400, if you want to carry on being part of the imperial system. And the vast majority of the landowning elites of the empire clearly do make that leap and have been Christian. So the conversion of the elite is a kind of late fourth, early fifth century phenomenon. The other big kind of take we have on further conversion is that in both the eastern and the western half of the empire, the determined effort to start to spread Christianity among the vast majority of the population who live in the countryside, so the peasantry, that these initiatives are all sixth century. So it looks as though elites convert in fourth, early fifth century, and then we start to try and build churches in the countryside to adapt the Christian message to a way that will work for peasants. That's a sixth century phenomenon. So there's, I think by the end of the sixth century, so about around the year 600, probably nearly everyone is being baptized and in that sense is a Christian of one kind or another. But it's clearly a time delay before we start really trying to spread Christianity systematically into the countryside.
What about the Middle East? How does Christianity, because that of course becomes important very soon. So how does Christianity spread in the Middle East?
It's the same, you know, that's part of the East Roman Empire. It's the same kind of time frame. And in fact, most of our sources for the late fourth and fifth century amongst Roman elites are actually people writing in Greek who are living in Turkey, Palestine, Syria. So it's the Middle East is actually the Middle East and the Near East, those parts of the Roman Empire, they're better documented. Egypt, too, in a different way, with all the papyri papyrological materials that survive. We know far more about those areas of the Roman Empire than we do about, say, Spain or Britain. We know a fair bit about Southern Gaul. There's quite a lot of sources from there. The Eastern Mediterranean is very well documented.
And we have to skip a little bit time frame because we had to have a lot to cover and we don't have time for to cover century by century, I'm afraid. But I want to skip to one very famous emperor of the Byzantine world, and that's of course Justinian. And I want to talk about Justinian and his because he was as well the last Latin emperor of the Roman world. So let's talk about the rule and how important Justinian is to the history of Christendom.
Yeah, he's very important because I think his kind of chief importance is to make sure that the official Roman version of Christianity remains the official orthodoxy. One of the things that then happened in the fourth and fifth centuries was a process of Christian doctrinal formation. The pre-Constantinian Christian church consisted of a lot of local communities that were in some contact with one another, but they had not arrived at defined doctrinal definitions of really crucial stuff like the Trinity. So in the fourth century, we see the emergence of the Nicene doctrine of the Trinity, the total equality of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And that is the Roman, that becomes the Roman official vision of Christian orthodoxy, not without a lot of argument, actually, and it nearly went in a different direction. But in the first generation or so, a lot of the new states that emerged on the territory of the old Western Empire in the late 5th and early 6th century, before Justinian's reign, they adopted a different version of the Trinity, a hierarchical Trinity, where the Father is more powerful than the Son. And Justinian's reign is crucial for destroying three of those successor states in the West that had adopted the non-Nicene Trinity. And it leaves the Nicene Roman official Orthodox definition of Christianity as dominant in the West. And I think there's a real chance, if Justinian's campaigns had not destroyed the Vandal kingdom, the Ostrogothic kingdom, and indeed the Burgundian kingdom by incidental action, if it hadn't done that, that this non-Nicene vision of Christian orthodoxy could easily become predominant in the West. So
we
I think
have
that's
to talk about,
his crucial contribution is that, I think.
And another thing that we have to talk about is, of course, the creation of Hagia Sophia, which, could you imagine Istanbul or Constantinople without that church, or without it? Because it's really hard to imagine Constantinople without Hagia Sophia or Saint Sophia, because it's really quite a marvelous and magnificent church. That really, it's a life goal of mine to see that church in person one day.
Yes, it remains an astonishing building. It's, I think, one of the favorite. I mean, I love going to Istanbul. It's a fabulous place to
and
visit.
And if I may, it still dominates the skyline of Istanbul, I think, to this
it,
day.
Yes. Yeah, it does. And if you think what most, you know, 6th century buildings would have looked like, its dominance at that point would have been colossal. In some ways, you're seeing the emergence of a purpose-built Christian architecture for the first time in the 6th century, of which Hagia Sophia is the prime example. There is no Christian architecture, no specific Christian architecture before Constantine, in the sense that people met in houses. You know, there's one of these that survives in the excavations of Dura Europus. And it's just an ordinary urban villa that has been decorated to be a Christian church on the inside. There isn't a separate building. Mm-hmm. And when they start building specific churches in the 4th century, they adopt the standard Roman public building form, which is the basilica. So it's the rectangle with two aisles of columns and an apse at one end. It's the standard Roman public building because Roman governors or Roman emperors used to sit in the apse, position of authority, but when it's adapted for Christianity, put the altar there. But it creates these kind of long, thin buildings with quite low roofs. That's the basilica form. And nearly every church in the 4th and 5th century is a basilica of one kind or another that we know about. And it's only in the 6th century that we start to see this experimentation that will produce this colossal dome structure to create a huge open space in the middle. And that's what contemporary commentators talk about when they talk about Hagia Sophia. There's a vast space in the middle and a huge space above your head. So your eyes are drawn to heaven. So instead of the basilica's roof closing you in and making you look at the east, you're looking towards heaven, towards the sky. The dome structure, the barrel structure, the barrel vault that leads up to the dome, that allows you to have much more light coming in than you would, and much more natural light have from basilica. And it's the light and the space and the height that overwhelms contemporary observers when they walk into Justinian's church.
And of course, it's not only unique and significant to this day, but still it also inspired, I believe, later Islamic, which we'll get to in a second, the mosque that we see in the Islamic world. It's hard to imagine what they would have looked like if it wasn't for Hagia Sophia, you know.
No, absolutely. And actually, in the 6th century, you see a lot of Hagia Sophia-like churches, not as grand, being spread around the Eastern Mediterranean. So when Islam emerges as a powerful religious force, the kind of vision of what a religious building looks like is kind of Hagia Sophia-like, not just in Constantinople, but in the other major cities of the empire that they take over.
So let's talk about the rise of Islam for a second, because that is also significant to the story how of Christianity, and we as again we will end with the Crusades, I think. But I want, because there is of course it's important, but so let's talk about the emergence of Islam and how that came to dominate the Middle East as well.
It's another important element in thinking properly about the rise of Islam, makes you think properly about Christianity and its rise to dominance. Islam is a kind of a further spin-off from Judeo-Christian tradition. It's another Abrahamic religion, and it's important to see that it belongs in the same family. Muhammad is inspired by Old and New Testament texts, and who am I to say I don't believe in any of this? Possibly by God as well. I don't know. I would not claim to have anything to say about this, but the theological context in which Muhammad is thinking is one that is informed by the Old and New Testaments.
It is said that Muhammad was illiterate himself. So, is that, do you support that claim that he was illiterate, or if he wasn't, so how could he be inspired by Christian texts if he was illiterate enough?
Well, I think most people are illiterate, of course, in the 6th century, but you get these texts read out in church week after week. So he clearly been in context. If you look at the surahs in the Quran, what they are doing, what most of them do, is start from a story from the Old or New Testament, and then take it in a new direction. But they start from the Old and New Testament stories. So, however, whatever, I mean, I don't know whether Muhammad was illiterate or not. I don't think anyone does really. But one way or another, the person who dictated or wrote the Quran knew their Old and New Testaments intensely. That is an inescapable starting point for understanding Islam. Islam is another religion out of the Abrahamic tradition. And takes obviously takes it in some new directions, but there's no doubting the starting point. And it's not dissimilar. I mean, you could write a paper comparing Muhammad and Constantine, really, that a whole series of military victories validate Constantine and his religion and allow him to make it the public religion of the Roman Empire, and likewise a whole series of military victories validate Muhammad and his message, and give it an afterlife and a permanence that it might not otherwise have had. Muhammad is, I think, able, Muhammad and his successors are able to win a colossal series of victories against Persia and against Rome. East Rome, because those two had been engaged in about 50 years of mutually destructive warfare before Muhammad comes to the fore, or as Muhammad is coming to the fore. And that's the crucial context for understanding Muhammad's ability to operate freely in Arabia and then to start conquering, is that Persia and East Rome, Constantinople, have fought themselves to a standstill. But very quickly, so between 630 and 660, this allows the new Islamic political unit to conquer Syria, Palestine, Egypt from East
And
Rome.
Spain, of course.
Eventually, yes, Spain by 720, the rest of North Africa by 690, and the entirety of the Persian Empire. So, I mean, this is an extraordinary strategic turnaround, if you like. So, everyone kind of takes the view in this period that victory comes from God. So, the only logical conclusion by 700 AD is that the Islamic world has identified the correct God, because they have won in a way that is totally astonishing, and where the divine legitimation of this message is completely unmistakable. That would be the contemporary.
Now, we should mention as well that unlike Christianity, the new Islamic Umar Caliphate, they were kind of hesitant in converting en masse, because, you know, in Islam, if you weren't Muslim, you had to, they weren't, I don't think they called themselves Muslims at the time, but let's do it for to simplify. If you weren't a Christian or Jewish, you had to pay a tax to and there was a kind of revenue outside of pillaging and conquering. So they were rather hesitant in converting Christians and Jews into.
Yes.
And at least in the early period, you had even the first generation converts had to pay tax to the Islamic, to the Umayyad caliphs as well.
Yes, that's right. There's clearly a long discussion, of which we only have part surviving, about whether Islam is meant to lead to mass conversion or not, whether it's a religion for a new chosen people who are the Arabs, or whether it's to be for everyone, and what the status of converts would be. Would they be totally equal to members, old Arab members who've been part of the enterprise from the beginning? Those kind of debates were clearly happening in early Islam. And what was the status of Christians and Jews who were recognized as being from the same religious family, peoples of the book being the Bible, and therefore could expect a reasonable degree of protection, but were clearly not absolutely on point with their religious message because they weren't Muslim. So early Islam is having to deal with those issues, which are much about its understanding of itself as its attitude to Jews and Christians. And it takes a while before it kind of comes to the conclusion that, yes, it is a mass religious movement, and that converts should have the same status as original old believers, and that this is to be a new alternative religious position. And certainly by the early 8th century, converts are beginning to be a major phenomenon. We know that one of the issues that powers the Abbasid takeover from the Umayyads in the 740s is that the Abbasids are willing to view converts as equals to older Arab Muslims. So that's, you know, the convert issue is clearly enormously important by the 740s.
Now, another thing I want to talk about as well is the coin wars. And I believe this is under the second Justinian in Constantinople and against Abdulmalik, who of course began first, because as you know, the image in Islam, early Islam, wasn't that controversial as it is today. So he's really the first, I believe, Abbasid caliph not to use the Byzantine coinage, which was the currency at the time. He began to remake the coins under his image, and it has been prophesied that the image is also of the prophet, I think. So, I don't know if that has been disputed quite yet. That seems most people think that is actually Abdulmalik himself and not the prophet. But let's talk a little bit about the coin wars that happened under Justinian II and Abdulmalik.
Yeah, it's the last moment where Constantinople thinks it might be able to reverse the losses. Because, you know, the key revenue-producing heartlands of the East Roman Empire have fallen under Muslim control in the course of the 6th century. And in the early 690s, Justinian II thinks that he sees an opportunity to reverse the conquests and win back some of these territories. So Syria, Palestine, Egypt, the really rich heartlands of the old Eastern Empire. He recruits a lot of Slavic soldiers from the Balkans, and he lays out a kind of ideological claim, part of which is to put the face of Christ on his coinage. The first time You'd had crosses, you'd had lambs. We'd never had the face of Christ on a coin before. And Justinian II does this as he reopens war against the Umayyad caliphs. And it's at that moment that Abdul-Malik changes Islamic coinage from echoing Byzantine forms to something very different. As you said, we get this extraordinary brief issue of what's called the standing caliph type of coin from the from Abdul-Malik, which is a figure holding a sword, a bearded figure holding a sword. And it's not clear who that is. Is it Abdul-Malik? But a bearded figure holding a sword could be Muhammad. It's unclear. It's a sign anyway that Islam is not so completely against images.
Do we have other images of Abdul-Malik that we can compare the coinage with?
Yeah, absolutely. And we also have these extraordinary Umayyad desert palaces from the Syrian hinterland. And they are painted with figural representations of people and rulers and whatever. So clearly, in its first two generations, Islam is not so absolutely iconoclast as it later became. But after a brief flirtation with this coinage type, which is either Abdul-Malik or Muhammad himself, it would make kind of sense if it's a kind of response to Justinian II that it would be Muhammad being put on the coins. But I'm not expert enough to decide this, and I don't know if it really can be decided. I don't know how you would decide it. But then we go to the absolute, what becomes the absolutely standard non-figural Islamic coin type, where you just have verses of the Quran on them, so no figural representations at all. And that happens pretty quickly in the 690s. So response A to Justinian's reopening of the wars and his positive assertion of the face of Christ on his coinage is standing caliph, but the long-term response is verses of the Quran and a completely aniconic coinage. And of course, Justinian goes on to lose and lose badly all his
He was not
Slavic.
like the first. He was not as the first Constantine to put it this way.
Yeah,
Sorry, not sorry. First Justinian, not the first Constantine, but first Justinian.
no, indeed. It didn't work. His policy didn't work. He's totally defeated. He loses his throne,
And
etc.,
his
etc.
nose.
And his nose, and actually, Constantinople is plunged into civil war and chaos for about 20 years in the aftermath of his defeats. Because when you claim to be God's special state in the cosmos, then defeat is a real problem because you have lost, clearly lost divine favor. Otherwise, you wouldn't be defeated, especially when you're being defeated by the forces of Islam. There is a serious questions to be answered there.
No, I want to leave the East for a little while and enter to Europe finally, because at a little later, I don't differ, you might not remember the date, but of course I want to talk about Charles Martel and the rising of his dynasty as under and Constant and Charlemagne as well. But I want to begin with the Charles Martel and the Battle of Tours. But as I want to say that I don't think personally that the Battle of Tours is that decisive. I think maybe they would the Umayyad in Spain would have spread a little bit into France, but I don't think, as Gibbon claims, that they would have been in England or the entirety of Europe would have been Christian. I think it's kind of over-exaggerated, the Battle of Tours, and of course, Gibbon helped a lot in making this exaggeration, but I don't think it would have been is that decisive what people make it out to be.
I suspect that's probably right. It's Gibbon did write awfully well about it. It's one of the best bits of Gibbon where he talks about if Charles Martel had lost, how madrasas would have spread across Europe, etc., etc.
I
But
don't think there would have been a Charlemagne, though, if that had happened. That might be fair.
yeah, no, that's fair enough. I mean, Charles Martel is Charlemagne's grandfather, and crucial. His victories are crucial. to establishing the legitimacy of what will become the Carolingian line, that's for sure. And the reunification of Francia under Carolingian rule goes, the victoriousness of Charles Martel is crucial to that process. And that might well have been threatened. But yeah, it's very hard to know. It doesn't, I mean, you know, it looks more like a series of Islamic raids, booty raids, rather than any serious attempt at conquest. But yeah.
So let's talk about, they made an episode about Charlemagne about a year ago, and I highly recommend the Stuart Airline. I highly recommend checking that one out as well. But, and this book is fabulous on the Carolingian dynasty, but let's talk about Charlemagne and his conversion in Germany, because that would of course become, as we again, we will get back to the Christianization of Scandinavia, the method they used there will be the Charlemagne methods as his of his Christianization of Germany. So let's talk about that for a while as well, and the founding of the Holy Roman Empire. Or of course that will be a later name for the empire, but let's talk about the founding of the of Charlemagne's empire.
Yeah, it's a crucial moment, I think, the formation of Charlemagne's empire. What you see is the reunification for the first time since the 5th century of most of the Latin West under one ruler. And Charlemagne clearly adopts the old Roman imperial ideologies that this kind of material political success is a direct reflection of God's favor, that it wouldn't happen otherwise, and that Charlemagne actually, to keep on deserving that degree of God's favor, needs to advance what he understands to be God's agendas within the areas of his control. And that you can see two things going on. One is conscious mechanisms for spreading Christianity, as you talked about, particularly in the conquest of Saxony, which is all about kind of forced conversion, but then further internal processes of church reform, correctio, correction, as the Carolingians call it. And Charlemagne does many things, but he's clearly committed to those two aspects of Christian agenda in a very systematic way. And he passes on that to his sons, to his son and heir, Louis the Pious. So you get a kind of 60 years of determined pushing of these kinds of Christian agendas from a dominant imperial court, and 60 years of careful allocation of some degree of substantial financial resource behind it as well. So this is a formative moment in the history of Western Christendom. In terms of internal reform, it is about defining a correct form of Christianity. You know, this is the Carolingian watchword, correctio, in the Latin, correct. There's one right way to do things. So we establish service books, we establish translations of the Bible and the Psalms and all the key service books. We establish sermon collections, and we try to make sure that these correct forms of religious observance will be spread across all the area under Charlemagne's rule. Before that, there were lots of local variations. People didn't seem to think that was a problem before Charlemagne, but Charlemagne is looking for a uniform, much more monolithic vision of correct Christianity, and starts to put the institutions in place that would allow that to be spread, as well as, of course, whenever it gets the opportunity, of spreading Christianity to new areas within Europe.
And again, of course, it started, well, it was mostly the elites that were affected by this. So were the lower classes still pagan somewhat, or were they kind of, how did that, because as we talked about I made an episode quite a while ago, 2 years now, I think, with Peter Wilson, where we talked about this in our episode on the Holy Roman Empire, where we speak about how, you know, mainly the elite were the Christian ones, and the pagans were kind of excluded, sorry, not pagans, but the lower classes were kind of excluded. So were there still paganism in the lower classes, or where did the classes?
I think if we were able to observe it, we'd find a lot of religious hybridity. that they have what would look to us a very strange mixture of religious behaviors and beliefs going on. One thing that's very important to realize is that there are hardly any churches still in the 9th century. The great era of European church building is 10th and 11th century. Charlemagne puts in place the incentives that lead landowners to build many more churches, but the actual building doesn't happen in his time. It happens in the 200 years after him. So the pattern that you observe now in sort of France or Germany or England, where you have a church in every village, that doesn't yet exist. You're still, most people are still maybe 10 kilometers from a church on average in the time of Charlemagne. And that
what
means
about monasteries? Are they starting to become the thing?
Yes, there's an impetus behind monastic foundation, particularly not so much Charlemagne, but his son, Louis the Pious, pushes through a process of monastic reform, a new vision of what correct monasticism should look like. And that slowly spreads. Again, none of this happens suddenly, but the new standards spread, are set at the Carolingian court and then spread slowly. But I think out in the countryside, you would find nearly everyone is being baptized. They probably go to church on major Christian festivals, like maybe two or three times a year. And if you ask them, they'd say they were Christian, but they would probably still be engaging in a lot of religious practices that would later be defined as pagan. So I think they would have, you would certainly have a Christian overlay, which would be around baptism and saying the Lord's Prayer, which they're supposed to learn by heart and probably did. I think it's fairly easy to learn the Lord's Prayer by heart, and saying the creed, the shortest of the creeds, learning that by heart. That's what baptismal instruction in the early Middle Ages consists of, and I find that perfectly plausible. So you could ask them to do that, but you know, for 90% of their religious lives, they would be on their own. They wouldn't have access to a Christian church. They would not have access to a Christian priest. And who knows what they would be doing on the ground, you know, in terms of trying to make sure that the crops grow, to fend off ill health, that their children survive, that there isn't a famine. You know, there would be all kinds of local responses to that kind of religious need, because the church was not in a position to provide a massive, fully defined alternative for them.
And now I want to leave European continent for a while, and of course go to England and not the United Kingdom, but the British Isles. And I want to talk about the Christianization there. And of course, you mentioned Bede quite a lot, and we made an episode on Bede as well a little bit earlier this year. But let's talk about how essential Bede is to understand the process of Christianization of, you know, the British Isles as well, because he's essential, isn't he?
He's absolutely essential. You could wish you had a narrative of Bede's intensity for everywhere that Christianity spreads. We would know a lot more if we did.
I'm sorry for interrupting you again, but I want to add as well, I read Bede myself, and though he is fascinating, it is not for everyone. You might say it can be tedious, how almost every page is devoted to how Christianity is the right religion. So it might not be for everyone to read, but for those who are interested, it's absolutely worth reading Bede.
Yeah, it's full of great stories. I mean, I love in particular his account of the crucial meeting in Northumbria where they're deciding to become Christian or not, and they're gathered in Edwin's Mead Hall. It's probably Yavering up in the Scottish borders, and the sparrow flies through the Mead Hall, and up stands one of Edwin's great retainers and says, what do we know of life? Life is like a sparrow. We're in the warmth and the light of the Mead Hall in one moment, and then the darkness on the other side, and we don't know what comes before and what comes after. And if Christianity comes along and tells us about the before and the after, then we should be grateful and we should adopt this model. It's a fantastic story. It's probably entirely fictitious, unfortunately, but it's a great story.
As is a story with a son, with a child who becomes healed by the well, as you know.
Yeah, maybe. Bead is essential, but it's clearly it's a very partial story. You have lots of other sources as well, and he tells us that it's the story of the way to understand Anglo-Saxon conversion in Britain is top down from royal courts, and I'm sure that's true. What he doesn't also tell you is that this meant that you had to adapt Christianity to become a religion for an elite that was a warrior elite. You know, this is what they did all day. That's the essence of what they did. They had to fight to maintain their land holdings. They had to fight against a lot of competitors from other kingdoms. They were tied into a judicial system which might lead them to, again, to wage war on behalf of a member of their king group against potential opponents. This is a problem compared to what Jesus has to say about violence in the gospel stories. And clearly Christianity, not only in, among the Anglo-Saxons, also among the Irish, who are similarly a warrior elite, Christianity has to make an adaptation to the needs of this new Christian constituency, Christian warriors. And you see a surprisingly lenient approach, or surprisingly lenient if you look at it from the Gospels, if that's your point of departure, surprisingly lenient approach to acts of violence and people who've had to engage in acts of violence, people who've had to engage in feud or fight in battle. Christianity has to become a viable religion for people who are going to have to do that. So you can't make those too much of a problematic act. They can't be something that confines you to hell or consigns you to hell, because if they did, Christianity would not work for these people. So there's a very interesting process of adaptation that takes place. It's probably also working amongst Frankish elites who are also warriors, of course, but it's better documented amongst the Irish and the Anglo-Saxons, whereby Christianity makes its peace with a martial elite.
I want to ask as well, because I want to go back all the way to the Roman times, when Constantine Christianized the Roman Empire. Were there Christians from that time in England, or did it not reach the English British Isles under the era of Constantine? Or how do we
it
know
certainly
anything
did.
About
I
it?
Mean, there's archaeological evidence. We know there are Christian bishops. They turn up at late Roman councils on the continent every so often. And actually, there's evidence from elite villas where pagan shrines are converted into chapels. So we know that Christianity does spread in the same kind of way amongst Roman landowning elites in Britain. But they're swept away by the process of Anglo-Saxon takeover in the 5th and 6th century. So I think in sort of central and eastern England, the bit that becomes Anglo-Saxon quite quickly, most of the bearers of Christianity who would have carried Christianity on into the post-Roman period, had they survived, they don't survive. And that's, so when the mission comes to Kent in 597, they are basically starting again. There probably are a few, well, there are documented a few Christian congregations, but they've been cut off for 200 years, and they need to be reorganized, and the church is starting again. There are no bishops, for instance.
And of course, the next topic of our agenda is, of course, the famous Scandinavians that enters Lindisfarne in the year 700s, which is, of course, the Vikings enter the chat. So let's talk about the Viking entry into the Christian world, and of course, the later Christianity attempt of the Vikings in Scandinavia. But there were attempts by German Christian missionaries in Scandinavia, but they were all, most of them, either taken slaves or they were, you know, killed themselves. There were attempts, but they never amounted to anything. other than Anjo's adventures in the Scandinavian world. So let's talk about the Vikings and eventually the Christianity, Christianization of Scandinavia as well, which you as well talked about.
Yeah, the Carolingian imperial period and its aftermath sees a great spread of Christianity northwards and eastwards across the European landmass, of which Scandinavia is one part. Charlemagne's conquest or forced conversion of Saxony, sort of top-down intervention, conquer everyone, make them become Christian. That's one model of spreading Christianity, but it barely, that's really the only occasion that it's employed. And actually, it's very difficult to do. The model that you whereby Christianity spreads over these much larger cases and eventually works in Scandinavia, but also in Poland and beyond as well, is one where local elites, a rising local dynast, decides that they will take on the imperial religion. And they're usually doing it in the context of using the relationship with nearby emperors to leverage their own position at home. So the Christianization of Scandinavia, the Christianization of Poland, Christianization of Bohemia, Christianization in Ukraine, all of these occur in contexts where one dynasty adopts Christianity in a context where it is establishing its power. In other words, it's part of a process of state formation, as we would call it, in these contexts. And it's about building, it's clearly about building alliances with imperial power when that is being perceived as advantageous for establishing your position at home. So it's actually very interesting. It's a kind of self-Christianization process in alliance with empires rather than Constantine's conquest, sorry, Charlemagne's conquest of Saxony model. That is too costly. No one does that. It's Christianity becomes an option, the option of choice amongst the dynast who would be king in various regions of northern and eastern Europe in the course of the 10th and 11th centuries. And it is the East Frankish world, which becomes the Holy Roman Empire, that clearly plays the crucial role in this. The Scandinavian kings, like Harald Bluetooth in Denmark, or the various Haralds
Olav Tryggvason in Norway, of course.
in Norway, they are in relationship with these new emperors.
I gotta say, it's interesting to me that Tryggvason actually Christianized Norway and not Saint Olaf, who's
Yes.
this giant, become more famous for obvious reasons. But he became saint and not Olav Tryggvason, who actually is the one who should be recognized for Christianizing Norway. He didn't even doesn't seem to get any credit at all. He doesn't have a chapter in Snorri, but he doesn't get much. I don't feel like he get much credit for Christianizing. Maybe today's new historians are trying to like give him more credit, but he does in at least up until now, he hasn't gotten much credit for Christianizing Norway.
No, well, history is always written by the winners. And of course, Tryggvason's dynasty is not the doesn't become the dominant royal dynasty. So he's, I mean, it's showing you how intense the competition is at this point between rival would-be dynasties who are regional bosses that want to become royal. They have to eliminate one another. That's a kind of Darwinian survival of the fittest process. And
I mean, to
the
be fair,
first
Saint
Olaf
Olaf
loses
as
out.
well. Sorry for interrupting you again, but Saint Olaf had lost, and he still become more famous. As you said, history is written by the winners, but Saint Olaf is arguably more famous, even though he did lose at the battle of supposed battle of Stiklestad as
Yeah,
well.
well, he loses in the short term, but his descendants make use of him. So, I mean, history's written in the, by the long-term winners, shall we say.
And it's interesting. I do think that I might be wrong here, but I do think that the son of Eirik the Red, who meets Tryggvason as well, is supposed to Christianize Greenland I think, but that is how he actually, by one of Tryggvason, that he accidentally discovers America as well when he gets that mission from Tryggvason as well.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And Tryggvason is very important in the conversion of Iceland, the Icelandic communities. Adopt Christianity to fend him off, so that he doesn't interfere in their lives.
So, how next? And something I want to—I don't mention this in the book, but I want to talk about this, and that we talked about this off the record. But that is, of course, the Christianization of Kiev Rus as well, because that, and that though it's probably most likely not true, you have this story that the leader, I don't remember his name, but the leader of Kiev Rus at the time wanted to choose a religion, and he chooses Christianity. Has three options, of course, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And I don't remember exactly how it goes, but it's a good story nonetheless. But in the end, his envoys does end up seeing Hagia Sophia, and they are so awestruck by Hagia Sophia, and that is why he chooses Eastern Orthodoxy as well.
Yes, it's Vladimir, or Volodymyr, if we do the Ukrainian pronunciation, whose statue is still there in Kyiv. There's clearly a context, again, of it's this same process of dynasties involved in state formation deciding which is the most advantageous religious position to adopt. The Rus in Kiev are sitting on top of river routes that lead them both to Constantinople and to the Islamic world. A lot of their trade is actually down the Volga into the Islamic world, more than is down the Dnieper into the Black Sea and then to Constantinople, although we know more. The texts tell us more about the Western branch to Constantinople, but the coins are telling us that actually the Islamic trade is really crucial. So, and we know that this Kievan Rurikid dynasty is slowly establishing its dominance over a series of other regional bosses up and down the Russian river routes. And that's the context in which they're making their choice. Vladimir's grandmother, Olga or Helga, had chosen, it seems, a Christian allegiance, but her son, Sviatoslav, rejects it. And in fact goes for a wacky own version of paganism. But then Sviatoslav's son, Vladimir or Volodymyr, goes back to a Christian allegiance, the same as his grandmother had had. So there's clearly a lot of religious contestation going on at the Kievan court, and a careful choice that's finally arrived at, that it will be Christianity. In this case, of course, it's Christianity from Constantinople rather than from the Holy Roman Empire, which is too far away. The linkages for Kyiv are with Constantinople rather than with Eastern Francia. So that's where that comes from. But it belongs in that same range of choices as we've seen in Poland and in Scandinavia. It's all in the same era. And it's in the same kind of context. It's part of this astonishing process of religious choice as part of state building, which creates a recognizable map of Europe by around about the year 1000.
So, of course, the next topic, well, we have a lot of ground to cover still, and the next big thing that happens in Christianity is the Great Schism, which would divide forever and still has divided the Eastern Orthodoxy with the Catholicism. So let's talk about what led up to the Great Schism, and it's one of the most important event in medieval Christendom, I think. And what led up to the dividing between the Catholic Church and Eastern Orthodoxy?
Yeah, there are two answers. There are two answers to that. One answer is a very particular quarrel over whether the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and from the Son, where the Latin Church had added the filioque clause and from the Son into the third part of the Nicene Creed. In other words, that the Son is just as much responsible for sending the Holy Spirit as the Father is, which wasn't in the original Nicene Creed. So there's a kind of technical quarrel over that. But I think that is as much pretext as cause. The real cause is the extraordinary rise to overarching religious authority of the Roman papacy, which occurs in the 10th, particularly the 11th and the 12th centuries, because the filioque clause, the teaching that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Son as well as the Father, that is championed by the papacy in the 11th and 12th centuries, and it's that which causes the Constantinopolitan Church to break away. But the context of this is that the Roman papacy was claiming and trying to assert positively for the first time a unique preeminence over the entirety of the Christian world, was prepared to push arguments, therefore, to the point of rupture. And this is what we see in the Great Schism of 1054. Well, we didn't know it was a great schism in 1054. It might have been healed. It wasn't, despite various attempts to do so. So it becomes a great schism in retrospect. But this is right at the moment where the Roman papacy is beginning to flex its biceps and is not afraid, for the first time, of pushing a quarrel to the max, as it were, with regard to other Christians living in other parts of the Christian oecumene, apart from the Latin West. And the rise of the papacy is such an interesting story. It's kind of an accidental knock-on effect of Charlemagne's empire, I think, in the sense that Charlemagne managed to create a set of church institutions and educational practices which produced over a whole sequence, unbroken sequence of generations, churchmen who understood themselves as being part of the same Christian church and understood that their practices were correct Christianity and therefore should be spread. But by the time we get to the end of the 10th century, there is no single power in Europe which controls all of Latin Christendom anymore. You know, the Holy Roman Emperor only runs Germany and northern Italy, doesn't run France, doesn't run Britain, doesn't run the new Christian states in Scandinavia, Poland, Bohemia, doesn't run Spain. So there is no single ruler anymore in the way that Charlemagne did, who runs all of Western Christendom. And what this means is that it's impossible for any secular ruler to sustain the unity that these churchmen feel. Because if a king of France calls a council, the bishops of Germany and northern Italy will not go to it. And if the Holy Roman Emperor calls a council, then only his bishops will go to it. There is no international Christian religious authority. And the papacy is actually created as a vehicle by these post-Carolingian churchmen who want a politically independent religious authority. And it is actually northern churchmen put into power in Rome, in the first place by the Roman Emperor, Holy Roman Emperor, who actually bring this more ambitious vision of the papacy to Rome and actually enact it in practice. And this is what we see happening in the 11th and 12th centuries.
So another thing I want to talk about is the papal state, because I find it a bit ludicrous that the Pope needs his own state or country, if you will, and even his own army. It's a bit, I mean, it made sense at the time, but still it's a bit ludicrous that the Pope, what did the Pope need an army, papal army for, which was created at the time as well, I believe.
Yes, it starts to emerge. I mean, it really emerges as the Holy Roman Empire breaks up. But it's a whole series of grants of territorial and financial rights across northern different parts of northern Italy, which as the which start with Charlemagne, reinforced by Louis the Pious, and then reinforced further in the 11th and 12th centuries, which when you add them up together create a sort of territorial dominance of the papacy in certain areas. The papacy needed a revenue, you know, needed sources of revenue to fulfill this grander role within Christendom. And the only way you can provide revenue for anything in the pre-modern world is to give it rights over lands, because land is what generates wealth in a pre-industrial, pre-modern economy. So you gave the Pope rights over various bits of territory. And when the Holy Roman Empire starts to break up, the Pope is left as de facto, with de facto control over these regions. And that's what gives us the papal state. I mean, not only Rome and its immediate surroundings, but also bits of land over by the Adriatic as well, and so on.
So, of course, the last thing we're going to talk about, we just covered quite a lot of ground. There's one thing, more thing I want to cover, and that is, of course, and I believe you end up the book somewhat there as well, the Crusades. And let's talk about, because Jerusalem has been in the hands of the rising Turkic powers, Seljuk Turks, for quite some time already, 90 years, I believe. We talked about this in our episode some 2-3 years ago about Anaxius Comnenus, and where we talked about how the Seljuk Turks has been under, no, sorry, Jerusalem has been under the Seljuk Turks for quite almost 80, 90 years up until the point of the Crusades. So when Alexius Comnenus does use the Seljuks for his own gain as well, but then he realized that they'd become a bit of thorn in his side for him. So what made him go to the Pope and say, hey, I need some army, I need some help with getting more soldiers to fight this, because our empire has fairly not competent enough soldiers. It was not intended in the first place to have hundreds of thousands soldiers on his doorstep on Constantinople. I think that made pretty clear.
Yeah, certainly. I think it came as a very nasty shock to him when that happened. No, Jerusalem had been in the hands of various Muslim rulers for centuries. What happens in the generation of Alexius, though, is that the Seljuk Turks had been taking over more and more of Constantinople's territories in what's now Turkey. And Constantinople's control after the Battle of Manzikert in 1076, you see a collapse. Manzikert is over by Lake Van. It's in the far east of Turkey. But after the Battle of Manzikert, which one of Alexius's predecessors loses, then the Seljuk Turks rapidly advance through what we call Asia Minor or modern Turkey and have taken over most of the Byzantine territories there. So there is an immediate crisis. The crisis Alexius wants is to get some Western help to push back against this conquest of Turkey. The Pope sells it, Pope Urban II sells it, on the other hand, as a mission to recapture Jerusalem, to restore it to Christian rule, and adds the some kind of promise that taking part in this expedition will get your soul to heaven. Exactly how is contested. Exactly what he said is not clear. But Urban is, as it were, on the same page as Alexius in that he's appealing to warrior elites in Western Europe, and particularly to the bit Urban came from southwestern France, and his preaching tour is in precisely the same area that he came from and to the elites that he already knew. So he's preaching to friends, neighbors, and distant connections. So he's looking for warrior contingents of a few thousand men to go to Constantinople and help Alexius retake lost Asia Minor. That part works, but we also get this extraordinary knock-on effect where unauthorized preachers pick up parts of Urban's message, particularly Peter the Hermit and others, and they start preaching crusade more generally. So in addition to contingents of warrior elites setting off for Constantinople, we get the so-called Peasants' Crusade, where 100 plus thousand people of all kinds, not military at all, just start heading off for Constantinople, sweep their way through the Rhineland, engaging in pogroms against Jews on the way, eventually most of them arriving outside Constantinople, and Alexius is absolutely horrified.
And I have to mention, of course, that according to the Alexiad by Anna Komnene, she claims that he was ready for this. He was prepared 100%. Of course, this is propaganda to immortalize her father and glorify him. But was this the case? Is she somewhat right, or is how prepared was he really? He's mentioned it was quite a shock, so he shouldn't have been that prepared as Anna Komnene claims he was.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, these people moved slowly. They would have realized, in Constantinople, you'd know by the time they got to Hungary that this was happening, and they would be here in about 6 or 7 or 8 weeks. You know, you could see it. It's not like they suddenly arrived, you didn't know they were coming, and then they're there the next day. You've got a bit of warning, but it's not what Alexius wanted. And he basically just transports them all across the Bosphorus as quickly as possible. And indeed, most of those people get massacred by the Turks in the autumn of the year, because they're not, you know, they're not soldiers, they're not ready for this. The main military contingent arrives a bit later, and that starts to win these victories. First of all, in Turkey, what becomes Turkey, but they're also not doing what Alexius wants, in the sense that he expected them to give him back control of every area that they liberated from Turkish control. And that wasn't their point of view. They did give him certain bits back in Asia Minor, what becomes Turkey, Nicaea, etc., goes back under Byzantine control.
And the Antioch never really becomes a Byzantine state again.
Absolutely. They keep on going from what's now Turkey into Syria, and then on into the Holy Land, and they clearly, we don't know when, large groups amongst them had no intention of returning those territories at all to Byzantine control. And when they win, which they do, I think, by incredible good fortune, as one contemporary commentator puts it, it's the second greatest miracle since the resurrection, that they do win. They should never have won. In fact, they find an Islamic world that's incredibly disunited. So, you know, they arrive at just the right moment. They nearly lose all the same outside Antioch. They're about to lose, and they miraculously win. But they do eventually win, and they just divide the Holy Land up. Or those of them who want to stay divide it up amongst themselves. But this is not what Alexius had in mind at all.
Now, I talked about the Holy... I mean, I've been to a friend of mine when I was in Vienna a little bit earlier who worked for the crusade, because we should mention that a lot of Jews do suffer under the road to the crusade, that get slaughtered, and the hypocrisy behind the crusade as well. We talked about, but you know, a friend of a friend of mine mentioned that, you know, we think about it that they are hypocritical today, of course, but the road to the crusade and the ideology behind it. But for 12th century crusader, this, and I think this is a fairly good point to mention, that while we think of it as hypocritical today, it made total sense for them. They didn't think they were bad guy running over, just reaching, making anarchy, or, you know, wreaking havoc upon Jews who were, you know, innocent Jews. They, for them, they made total sense. They felt like they were like this Christian, holier than thou kind of thing, that were going to reconquer the Holy Land, Jerusalem. But it wasn't what we think about today, this ludicrous kind of vandals or barbarians, for lack of better words, that were roaming through Europe until Constantinople or Jerusalem. And I think that's a fair... That kind of made me rethink this a little bit, because it makes a lot of sense that he had, from their point of view, they weren't, you know, these barbarians that they came to, that we think of today, that were hypocrites that came to Jerusalem.
History throws up a lot of difficult judgmental questions like that one. I mean, it's extraordinarily problematic enterprise this crusade enterprise, and a huge numbers of people die, and it's doomed. I mean, you know, they only win by accident. As soon as the Islamic world restores its unity, they reconquer the Crusader states, and they're always going to. You know, no matter how complicated and wonderful the fortifications you put up in the Holy Land, there are never going to be enough resources coming out of Western Europe to sustain this colonial domination
And I
of
do
the Holy
believe there
Land
is this. I'm
in
sorry
the
for
12th
interrupting
century.
you. I'm
Yeah.
sorry for interrupting you again, but that's what I meant point out this. I'm using the story when you mentioned fortification. I believe this ended the Third Crusade when Saladin, the Christians build. I don't think it's King Arthur, sorry, not King Arthur, but King Richard the Lionheart. But then they build this fortification, and then that uses ages to build, and then they just Saladin goes and then, hey, why don't we trade this for another thing? And then, you know, kind of without even fighting. So there is some amusing stories as well that they built the
Yeah.
ages, this fortress, and then Saladin just goes like, hey, why don't we trade instead of fighting?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's an unsustainable Christian enclave. It was never going to be sustainable in the long term. But you do see some interesting alternative responses. I mean, I mentioned that the Peasants' Crusade engaged in these pogroms against Jews in the Rhineland en route. And some of the bishops, famously the Bishop of Speyer, tries to protect his Jewish citizens within his town. He takes them inside the cathedral precincts in order to kind of protect them from these murderous gangs who are roaming around. So there isn't yet a kind of single view, monolithic demonization of Jews within Christian church circles in the 11th century. I mean, that becomes stronger, in fact, during the crusading period. So by the 13th, there probably is, but not yet in the 11th. And one effect of the crusade is to draw very strict dividing lines between these communities and to reinforce those dividing lines, I think.
And I do believe Barbarossa as well was famous for protecting Jews in his
Yeah.
empire as well, which I find ironic that Hitler later on would name Barbarossa invasion of Russia, Soviet Union, after him when he actually protected Jews in his empire as well.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
So
No, that's right.
I think we're going to end it there, and I think we made a fairly good overview over the Christianization of Europe. We talked for quite a while already. So, Cross, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. And before you go, do you have anything you want to promote? Where can people buy your book, Christendom? And the Triumph of a Religion, of course. And do you have any social media you want to share, or do you, where people might find you if they have any further question on the Christianization of Europe or Christendom in general?
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm an old-fashioned medieval historian, so I don't really do social media, but you can find my email address online really easily, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions that anyone has. Just drop me a line. It would be my pleasure to answer them.
Thank you so much again for coming on. And this has been Without Age Dwell. I hope you liked this episode. If you liked it, please check out some other episodes you might like as well. We are available on social media under X, formerly known as Twitter, or on Instagram under Without Age Dwell. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you are on Apple Podcasts, consider writing a review of our podcast, and I will try to read it on the podcast if I see it. If you are on Spotify, like, give us 5 stars. That will help us out a lot. If you are on YouTube, like, share, and subscribe. And I'll see you next time.